This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 15th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 92nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're making like Status Quo, always heroes of mine. Why? Because I like it, I like it, I like it, I like it, la 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 like it, la 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 like it. Here we go. Oh, we're rocking all over the world. Today we are defined by our internationalism. We are going to Montreal to laugh out loud as we learn about how the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival keeps ahead of the game in booking tomorrow's next stand-up comedy megastars.
If you want to see Eddie Izzard swapping notes with Larry David and asking Joan Rivers where she's touring next, that's where you're going to see it happen.
We'll take a trip to France to meet Giles Peterson, the globe-trotting maestro of the mixtape, this time putting on a festival of his own.
So that for me was really the essence of this festival, to incorporate jazz, soul, heritage music, electronic, the avant-garde, and a big dose of DJ culture.
And we'll delve between the covers of a handsome new book that celebrates the best of the world's advertising over 60 years at the Cannes Lions Advertising and Creativity Festival.
They were the game changers of that time. They steered the work coming out of that time. So we wanted their story to just be a personal story of when they were working in the industry.
Plus, there'll be live music from the hyper-talented Cameroonian singer-songwriter Nitjam Rosie, and we'll be following all Brazil's bookworms to the Flip Literary Festival. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Spin the globe and find a bit we haven't been, baby. First things first, song time. This week's exclusive live Midori House session comes courtesy of Cameroonian-born Rotterdam resident Nitjam Rosie. We'll have a chat with the wonderful singer-songwriter later in the show, of course. But first, here she is with a cover of Anita Baker's Sweet Love.
With all my heart, I love you, baby. Stay with me and you will see my arms. We'll hold you, baby, yeah. Never leave, 'cause I believe in this love. Sweet love, hear me calling out your name. I feel no shame in love. Sweet Lord, don't you ever go away. Always be this way. Your heart has called me closer to you. Yeah, I will be all that you need. Your stress in what we're feeling, never leave, 'cause I believe in this love. Sweet love, hear me calling out your name. I feel no shame in love. Sweet Lord, don't you ever go away. It will always be this way. This way. Well, there's no stronger love in this world, no. Oh, baby, no, you're my man, I'm your girl. I never go, wait and see, can't be wrong. Don't you know this is where you belong? I'm in love. Sweet Lord, hear me calling now. Sweet Lord, don't you ever go away. It will always be this way. This way. This way.
That was Nitjam Rosie performing Anita Baker's Sweet Love. And if you like what you heard there, there's more of her to come later on in the show. First over to Montreal, where Just for Laughs, the largest international comedy festival in the world, has just kicked off. We're taking a three-pronged attack to Just for Laughs this year. Yes, that's right, because prong sounds a bit like it might be a bit rude, and that's funny. Actually, it's such a multifaceted, large and long festival for the biggest, hottest and most upcoming comedians, agents and punters that it needs to be tackled in bits. The festival started life as a 16-act, two-day event in 1983, and last year hosted 250 shows and 4,000 acts. But how do they keep it so damn funny? How do they make sure it's all... and not. First up, we sent our Toronto bureau chief, Nelly Godcheva, to check out what's so funny over in Quebec. She caught up with program director Robbie Praw.
We have never booked this many women at the festival this year. We have 10 galas, 6 of them are hosted by women. So we have Sarah Silverman coming, Joan Rivers, Kathy Griffin is one of our hosts, Whitney Cummings. So we loaded up on women, and that's just our galas. We also have people like Amy Schumer, Kristen Schaal, and essentially I got married this year, and it's inspired us to book more women. My wife's inspired us, I guess. Yeah.
So what is the hottest ticket in town right now?
We're lucky that we have a lot of hot tickets right now, but I would say Sarah Silverman's a really hot ticket right now.
Kind of expected.
Joan Rivers is a hot ticket at 80 years old, I mean, which is, I find, amazing. But also, I mean, we have Seth Meyers coming, you know, and he just got the spot after The Tonight Show, which he'll be taking over soon, so that's really going well. But also, this Wednesday, we're starting with The Ethnic Show, which is, you know, if there's a show that speaks to Montrealers, better than The Ethnic Show, I don't know it. So we're starting with that on Wednesday.
I've been told The Ethnic Shows and The Nasty Shows. What are The Nasty Shows?
Well, The Nasty Show is one of our most popular shows for decades now. What that show is we go around and we have a checklist of the most inappropriate subjects possible. And what we try to do is, very methodically, we try to make sure that every disgusting topic is covered. And then we put all those comedians together and we throw them up at Club Soda and Metropolis starting next week, the week after next week. And wow, that show offends everybody. Every year people walk out offended, but it's hilarious. And we have one of the best lineups we've ever had this year. So we're really excited about that.
And okay, you know, like you're talking about like really big names. So I was wondering how well in advance would you start booking those people?
So this festival ends on the 28th. And we have people from our team going to Edinburgh to start the scouting for next year a week later. So, I mean, we're already having meetings talking about, hey, we should do this next year, you know, and it never stops.
Do you think that people from different countries have different sense of humor? So different type of shows would actually attract people from different countries. Let's say your nasty show or then, you know, like, or the ethnic shows and stuff. Would they like, have you noticed like any particular type of people coming to see those? And is it actually explained by the country where they're coming from? Or is it actually just down to what kind of people they are?
Take the ethnic show, for example. I don't even know if we have one Canadian on the show. It's a very Canadian kind of idea, ethnic groups. You know, in Canada, it's very much, mosaic of different ethnic groups. Whereas in the States, it's the famous melting pot. So, but really, it's all about the type of person you are and how you're going to respond to a show. I mean, everyone's a little bit different. Like, for instance, one of my best friends in the UK comes to our alternative show every year. And every year he just turns to me and he's like, the thing that you call the alternative show, we would just call a show in the UK. Because, you know, comedians then, or the art form is a little more alternative in the UK. But like I said earlier, everything is sort of slowly jumbling together. I mean, for example, we have Eddie Izzard hosting a gala this year. Eddie has picked his own lineup, and he picked the biggest star from South Africa is on the show, Trevor Noah. And then he has Gad Elmaleh, the biggest star from France on the show. So theoretically, you would think, wow, these are huge stars from places that have nothing to do with each other, and that's going to be one of our biggest shows that people are going to enjoy. I'm 100% positive. So yes, people are different, but generally I'm different than a 17-year-old Montrealer who has an entirely different experience than me. So I wouldn't say geographical differences are that different. I would just say people are different.
So what about age range? Like, what is your main targeted group?
We only target Jews over 70 years old. That's no, I'm kidding. The Montreal Festival has something for everybody. I mean, you could go with your family and go outside to see great parades. I think we have dozens of food trucks, you know, from different cuisines from all around the world. That's not saying that everybody belongs in each show. I mean, my mother is banned from walking into the Nasty Show, for instance. She'll enjoy it, but I personally don't want to watch her laughing at some of those jokes, you know? But with that being said, I mean, you know, there, if you have any type of sense of humor or joie de vivre, there's going to be a show at our festival that is going to be the favorite comedy show that you've ever seen.
That was Robbie Praw, Director of Programming for Just for Laughs Montreal, talking to Nelly Gotcheva. Well, one man who's making the journey over to Canada for the event is comedian, comedy journalist, veteran Just for Laughs attendee and pal of the show, James Mullinger. We wanted to know how to navigate the festival, so he stopped by to talk us through his tactics.
The number one place is definitely going to be the Hyatt, which is where all of the comedians are staying. It's also the Just for Laughs base. It's where the press office is. It's where they're doing recording radio shows and doing all kinds of things like that. It's also where all the deals are being done. And every year they have a top comedian. Last year it was Patton Oswalt doing a State of the Industry address, where he will get up and talk about the state of the industry and where things are at. And it's always just a brilliant...
So it's like a sort of comedian's AGM sort of thing.
That's exactly what it is. It's a comedian's convention. The one thing that all the comedians say to you is that it's the one festival where everybody's having a good time. All the comedians there are at the top of their game. You know, the scouts literally travel the world finding the best comedians in the world. And these could be new faces or obviously legends like Joan Rivers, and they book them all to come. So there's no one there struggling. No one's having a bad time at stand-up. It's all the creme de la creme who are all happy with where they're at in their careers, generally.
So there's no sort of slack to make up. Although there are undiscovered people who are there to be discovered and who will be during the festival.
Absolutely. But I think the important point is everyone's having a good time. So it's not, you know, while it is industry driven, while there are lots of deals being done, basically, because most of these comedians obviously now are touring solo, they don't get a chance to hang out with their friends. So it's like a comedian's holiday. The atmosphere in that Hyatt bar at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the morning is second to none. And of course, you know, you can really see act that you wouldn't normally see hanging out. They don't have time to hang out the rest of the time because either they're sitting in a, you know, a 5-star hotel somewhere on their own crying.
or they're stuck. How the mighty fall.
So as a result, you know, I think the Hyatt is the place. If you want to see Eddie Izzard swapping notes with Larry David and asking Joan Rivers, you know, where she's touring next, that's where you're going to see it happen.
And presumably there are lots of sort of dive bars. There are lots of smaller venues, which are, you know, presumably with every stage, there are
Absolutely.
Three attendant bars that go with it. Yeah. Is this the kind of the vibe of Just for Laughs, that it is stage, drink, catch another show? Is it a proper festival where people roll on and roll on like a music festival is?
Absolutely. And it does have a fringe element. I mean, this is the thing, is obviously a lot of the shows are in big 3,500 seaters. Eddie Izzard is hosting a big gala there. Sarah Silverman is. These are the big posh theatres which are being filmed for TV. But you do meet, I met lots of punters who'd come from all over the world to visit, as people do Edinburgh. And, you know, they would just come and book tickets, you know, back to back. You know, you can go and see a show at 9 till 10, then at 10:15, and you can see 3-4 shows in a night and then just, you know, drink the night away.
And finally, we should talk about, you're going to be blogging about the festival this year when you go out. And how does that work for you? Because you presumably have to sort of keep your powder dry. You need to see as many acts as you can to be able to judge how good the festival was. But you obviously need to party and be able to, you know, to be able to live the dream, the comedy dream as well. How do you time it? Where do you go at what time?
I basically try and cram, I mean, the same thing I do with my life day to day, is cram in as much work and partying as possible. Yeah, you just find the energy, and ultimately you have to see, you know, you have to see as many shows as possible. I'll probably be there for 4 or 5 days. There's so much energy in the festival that you don't kind of get tired. You want to get, you know, you wake up and, you know, the temptation to kind of lie in your hotel all day isn't there, because of the fact that you know that you're going to walk downstairs and see, you know, everyone from Eddie Izzard to Jimmy Carr there swapping notes. And that thrill and buzz, I think, is what, you know, most people love about it. And as I know has been discussed before, you know, Robbie Praw, who's in charge of programming, is a master when it comes to this stuff. You know, he personally is traveling around finding the best acts in the world. You know, they don't need to, you know, obviously they have the legends there for the sake of ticket sales, but they find the best new talent. And, you know, as I know this has been pointed out before, but, you know, this year there is a very, very high female hit rate of comedians. And this isn't a kind of, you know, them trying to make a feminist statement or kind of make a point. The simple fact
is... This is the cream rising to the top.
Exactly. You know, Tig Notaro, you know, is, you know, she's kind of new to the world. She's been performing for 15, 20 years, but she famously performed a set at Largo in Los Angeles about a year or so ago when she'd been... I think she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer and came up and did a set which Louis C.K. happened to be recording, and he released it on his website and it got 1 million downloads, and now she's getting the recognition she deserves after years on the circuit. You know, so that's why she's there. Amy Schumer, similarly. All of these female acts, they're there because they're awesome. It's not a statement, and it just happens that at the moment the most exciting acts in the world happen to be women.
That was James Mullinger talking to me there, but not content with meeting one funny man to highlight the idiosyncrasies of Just for Laughs, we picked two. So back to Montreal. Here's what happened when Nelly collided with local comic Mike Patterson.
Out of theater school, I would take like places and turn them into theaters. I would just get like, I'd build a stage and I'd make coffee can lights and I'd put on a play. And then some stand-up comedians came by this one place that I turned into a theater. They're like, we should do a show. And I was like, I will do a monologue. And they were like, no, you should just tell some jokes. And I was like, all right. And I did really well. And then they brought me to the clubs. And it turns out that now I'm still a stand-up.
So tell me, you're an American man in Montreal. Why are Canadians so funny?
I'm only half American. I don't really tell people that I'm American. I've been living here since I was 14. I'm touchy about that because I think my humor comes from Canada. My weird accent comes from the States and Laval. Why are Canadians funny? Because we don't care as much. We don't, like, all we want to do is have a good time. We want to enjoy ourselves. We don't take it that seriously. I think Americans take everything serious. I'm American. This is serious stuff. There's no A in America, and I'm not that serious.
Do you think that Canadians are nicer, even when it comes to comedy?
Well, comedians, it depends. If some comedians are the nicest people in the world, and some people are really mean. It's really hard, and I'm one of those nice guys, but I definitely think that Canadians are nicer as a people. Have you ever met Newfoundlanders? Those guys, it's like in their like charter that they have to help you. Those guys are incredibly nice. Ontario, yeah, they're kind of like, I don't know, I'm kind of nice. But once you get out like Manitoba, Alberta, those guys are nice.
Tell me about this year's edition of Just for Laughs. Who are you looking forward to seeing?
I'm one of the people that like, I like hanging out with friends. So for the most part, I'm really excited about a food truck in the Quartier du Spectacle. So generally what you do is you go to the Quartier du Spectacle and there'll be like somebody walking by on stilts doing clown stuff and you go, ha ha ha, and you eat a sandwich. I'm really excited about that. I'm a fat guy that just wants to eat food and then you'll go experience comedy somewhere, which is great.
That was comedian Mike Patterson talking to Nelly Gotcheva. Just for Laughs Montreal kicked off last week and runs throughout the city until the 28th of July. So if you're in the area and fancy being offended or just having a good time, just visit hahaha.com. This is Culture, where from Montreal we're getting in our private culture jet next to take a musical journey around the world. Stay tuned.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and onto Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where from comedy festivals we move now to music. It's that time of year where festival fever takes over the Northern Hemisphere, and with a lineup that includes Syrian funk, Armenian piano jazz, New York hip-hop, and Afrobeat-inspired Parisian electro-boogie-woogie, there aren't many festivals that can claim to be as international as Giles Peterson's Worldwide. Now in its eighth year, the event continues to bring a niche of musical eclecticism to the otherwise sleepy town of Sète in southern France. We sent Monocle producer Alid John to track down the man behind the festival and some of the groups bringing that worldwide sound to the Sète.
What's up, Worldwide? How are you feeling right now?
Giles Peterson, DJ, music producer and festival curator, has spent his career espousing the delights of artists and oeuvres less heard of in the British and Western popular music scene. His work behind the turntables has for more than two decades brought Latin jazz, house and dance to the clubs on Europe's shores, while reminding the curious listener of the hidden genre-crossing gems of years gone by. His festival, Worldwide, brings these aims into sharp focus for a week of musical eclecticism by the sea in the south of France. I caught up with him at his studio in London to find out why he conceived the idea of the festival in the first place some 8 years ago.
The thing about the Worldwide for me was a little bit of a response, I think, to having spent 10 years curating music for the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. After 10 years, they decided to knock it on the head, and I was a bit hurt by that because I'd brought so much sort of exclusive special events to that festival, which I felt had definitely lacked in edge for many years. It lived off its reputation for quite a while. I did a gig in Montpellier and it was so good. I remember telling the guys with whom I was doing the gig, because normally in France when you do gigs, you tend to, it was always good in Paris and Lyon, but regionally France was never that easy a place for DJs like myself. But suddenly in Montpellier, I suddenly found something really good. And the guys putting on the events there, I said to them, do you know somewhere we can do a little festival where we can sort of incorporate all the sort of bits and musical pieces that I sort of incorporate in my radio shows? And they're like, oh yeah, you gotta go to this little fishing town, sort of a bit different, it's called Set.
Set is a funny place, at once populated by fairly nonplussed, sun-kissed locals, enjoying what seems to be the definition of the good life, but also by the thousands of people who descend on the town to enjoy the delights of the many music festivals that take place over the summer months. Let's head down to the St. Christ venue, the lighthouse at the end of the town's pier, to find a Brazilian man whose music was first championed by Giles Peterson on this side of the pond, Marcus Valle.
Alô, som, hey? More voice for me, please. Alô, som.
I started in 63. I have done a lot. I have started very early in Brazil. When I was 20, 21, I started to have my first songs recorded. Then I started to record by myself. Immediately after that, I have a song by the name of Summer Samba, so nice, that became a hit in Brazil and a hit out of Brazil. Then I went to United States and stayed there. And then I started to go to Europe. Giles Peterson was one of the guys who started to play my music in the clubs in London. And then I got a new audience, a young audience.
The role of Giles Peterson as a man who introduces your music to another crowd, how important a role does he play for you?
Giles Peterson, it was very important because he was one of the first DJs that started to play my music in London. And so he did a very good job. Until today, I think Giles Peterson, he does a fantastic work, not only with the Brazilian music, but music from everywhere. So that's why I like very much to join his festival and anything that he needs.
That's Brazil done. Now on to France, the home of this festival and one of the more eclectic performers on the lineup, Xavier Thomas, aka De Bruyt. De Bruyt hails from Bretagne, moved to Glasgow, Paris, then London, and now resides in Brussels, from where he carves out his niche. Electro music, whose influences are so diverse, it defies easy definition.
The thing I do when I play, I play live, so I play with some machines, I don't have any turntables, and I only play my music, so my productions, I don't really DJ.
What draws you to African and Middle East influences?
The African stuff came when I was kind of experimenting with polyrhythmic sounds in electronic music, and I just realized that some people were actually doing it live with some acoustic music, and I was really impressed by all the groove and the complexity of the drums, but in a really natural way.
What is it about live playing that attracts you?
It's hard because a DJ has all the choice in the world between all the most amazing tracks that have been produced, like during the history of recorded music, and I only have my own tracks, so it should be impossible to compete with a great DJ. But I can do something on the music that DJ can't, because they only have a left right on two turntables most of the time, and I have access to all the little layers and beats and synths and little things in my own music, so I can do more little things and make it sound really lively, like it can change and surprise people like in a second, basically.
Back at the studio in London, Giles Peterson reflects on what has changed over the years since the first worldwide festival.
I just wanted us to treat the live musicians and the DJs in the same way, and for it to be as good for everybody, and for this complete diversity of sound to be able to make sense on a festival. Because I find as well, a lot of festivals, they just have it, it's eclectic, but it's not particularly got any rhythm, or there's no sense to it. And for me, you know, there has to be a sense. So that for me was really the essence of this festival, to incorporate jazz, soul, heritage music, electronic, the avant-garde, and a big dose of DJ culture. I wanted to do a festival which is going to give a lot of the DJs and musicians and artists that are part of the same kind of like-mindedness, you know, I think that it just allowed us all to be able to meet together, and it keeps us all encouraged and gives us all a big boost. We need that. I think that's what certain industries do better than others, and certain types of music have done better than others. I think that house music and the rave scene, they were very good at really sort of getting a little bit of energy and really marketing themselves. Yeah. I was always a little bit happy. I was always like, oh no, I'll just be in the back room playing my weird music. And actually in the end you go, actually no, I think we need to celebrate what we do and the more alternative DJs. So that's the idea of this festival, and hopefully it gives everybody a nice boost.
That was A Journey Around the Globe, courtesy of Giles Peterson's Worldwide Festival and our man, Alid John. And though you may have missed the event for this year, there was plenty of inspiration there for some good listening, and more still if you visit the website gilespetersonworldwide.com. Still to come in part two, we'll be spending some more time admiring the vocal talents of Nit Jam Rosie. We'll explore the themes of Brazil's leading literary festival, and we'll meet the editor of the book seeking to map out the adverts that changed the game. That's Music, Books and Admin still to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So before we head over to Brazil, let's enjoy some more of that sweet sound from Nit Jam Rosie performing songs from her great new record At the Back of Beyond. The two of us had a lot to talk about when she came in to see us at Midori House, but first of all, here she is with Je Me Confie.
Je t'en prie, ne me touche pas. Ne me regarde pas comme ça. Mon cœur pèse lourd dans la balance, yeah. Ça me rend mal à l'aise cette danse, yeah. Je fais semblant de t'ignorer. Je ne pourrai jamais justifier ces sentiments interdits. C'est pour ça que je fuis. Je t'en supplie, ne te rapproche pas. Parle-moi, mais ne baisse pas ta voix. Ton âme est si loin de la mienne. Quelle chance, yeah. Je ne veux plus écouter cette cadence, yeah, yeah, yeah. Je suis en train de m'éloigner de toi, n'essaye pas de me trouver des raisons rationnelles et spirituelles, parce que je pense à elle. À son amour je me confie, la patience de mon Jésus. À son amour je me confie, il ne m'a jamais déçu. Son amour je me confie, la patience de mon Jésus.
I've got to ask you the first question. Doing a little bit of research on you, mm-hmm. even on your own website, I said, oh yeah, I took singing lessons. Who on earth did you have singing lessons from to sound like you sound? And when did that happen?
Well, I've been taking singing lessons since I was 14. I'm 30 now. So
okay.
From several women. But I learned a lot at the conservatory in Rotterdam, I think. Yeah. Connie de Jong is one of my favorite teachers. She taught me a lot about singing and what it means to be a singer and to how to use your voice and stuff. And of course, God gave me this talent, you know. It's what I...
Well, that's how it sounds, you see. That's why I can't believe that anyone's going to tell you how to do it or how to train it.
Yeah, it's...
You've had greatness thrust upon you.
Yes, I believe that. So.
And the album is called At the Back of Beyond.
Yes.
Tell us about the title.
I stole it. from the movie Black Narcissus.
Yeah.
From the Archer brothers or something.
Yeah. And obviously the session that people are hearing on this show today is a stripped down sound of yours. Because the record is has more of an old school jazzy vibe to it, and it's got the soaring vocals and all the stuff that people have heard. What's it like stripping down your songs when you do smaller venues, when you do radio stuff? Because it's kind of you play this really hypnotic sort of looping guitar, and it's that's a kind of universe for people to get into. That's got, I guess it's more focused on your voice when you're
It's more focused on the voice, the lyrics.
Yeah.
The melody, of course, and the vibe. You just see Rosie and the voice. I mean, that's where it all started. I started writing with my voice. I didn't play guitar or piano or anything. I just had my pen and the voice.
And you talked about the vibe there. Mm-hmm. What vibe are you in when you're writing songs? Are you in the same vibe as you are when you're performing? Are they two different things? Is one a little bit more about the head when you're writing stuff, and performing is a little bit more about the heart?
It all depends on what you want to come across and what the message of the song is, let's say. So sometimes it just comes from above and you have this song and you just write it down and you don't even understand. And sometimes you can also think, I want to write a song about this matter, political matter, or, you know, so it all really depends on the mood you're in or what TV show you were just watching, or the situation, breakups.
The gamut, all the classics, right?
Anything can be
breakup, makeup, love song, exactly.
Yeah, a tool to write, yeah.
And there's a lot of soul. There's a lot of soul in there as well. Mm-hmm. And is that? Is there the influence of the things you listened to when you were a kid in your records, or is it the stuff that you just kind of have made, or it's the stuff that you know that you can perform with your voice? Is that what lends it to a soul sound and a sort of jazz sound?
I think we all have our musical luggage.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's a lot of pop music when I was really little. Pop, like from Madonna.
Come on,
to, like,
spill the beans.
Madonna, the 80s,
that's
the
good.
First album. And yeah, really. I love her 80s stuff. I love 80s music. Prince, late 70s soul. You know, Donny Hathaway is super jazzy and still very soulful. I mean,
and you played an Anita Baker track, which is a bit more.
Yeah, like more 90s.
More, yeah, exactly.
I love R&B, like SWV kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I studied Brazilian music. Javan and all kinds of. I have like.
So if you were drumming as well as playing guitar, we wouldn't be able to see your hands move. Right?
No, but you know, so. And I'm from Cameroon and I love music from over Richard Bona is from Cameroon too.
Yeah.
Like really. So I have this groove bass. A basic thing in me, and jazz harmonies, I just fall for them. Like, I love jazz harmonies, and I love the breeziness of pop music. So it's a bit of crossover.
See, it's a happy mess, isn't it? And I
guess,
do you think that people, if you'll excuse the description,
no,
it is a sort of happy
yeah.
confluence of all these things. A happy confluence of all these things sounds nice and a happy mess. That was the beautiful Knit Gem Rosie talking to me there. Her album, At the Back of Beyond, is out now, and she's playing some dates in the Czech Republic and the Netherlands later this year. Her website is knitjamrosie.com. If you want to find out more, I'll spell it for you. It's NTJAM, Rosie with an I. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Time to cross to Brazil now, where the 11th annual Flip Literary Festival wrapped up recently in the colonial town of Parati in Rio de Janeiro State. Flip is the place where homegrown writers are celebrated and promoted, and where a new generation of Brazilians have been inspired to become avid readers. This year's festival paid homage to Graciliano Ramos, a Brazilian modernist writer who wrote predominantly about the inequality gap in the northeast of Brazil in the 30s and 40s. It's a fitting topic given the recent month-long protests throughout the country, where hundreds of thousands of Brazilians shared their frustration at the continuing gap between rich and poor. Sheena Rossiter flipped out and sent us this report.
Horseshoes clack against the wobbly cobblestone streets of Parati's historical center as carriages slowly lug tourists through the main sights of this colonial Portuguese town sitting on the sleepy coast of Rio de Janeiro. The town's charming setting and its unreliable mobile and internet services hark back to a time that once was. But more importantly, the enchanting backdrop, seemingly free from modern distractions, makes it a perfect place to host a literary festival for great thinkers, readers, and writers alike. Around 25,000 people have flooded the town to attend FLIP, Brazil's most prominent literary festival. They are here to listen to the thoughts of some 40 authors, from the likes of Lydia Davis to Brazilian musical great Gilberto Gil, with many paying homage to the Brazilian modernist writer Graciliano Ramos, the theme of this year's FLIP festival. President and founder of FLIP, Liz Calder, explains why this author was chosen.
We all thought it would be a good way of making Brazilian literature better known in other parts of the world to each year have an homage to somebody who means a lot in terms of Brazilian literature but might not be well known overseas. In the case of Graciliano Ramos, his work is not very much translated into English. I think only one book is available, which means that this spotlight, I hope, will generate interest in other publishers bringing out more of his work. But as far as the Brazilian audience is concerned, I think it's being received very warmly indeed, because he's obviously an author who means a lot to Brazilians, and particularly right now at this moment where a lot of questions are being asked and his view of the world seems to coincide with what people are asking and what they're finding difficult to accept.
In a twist of fate, the homage to Graciliano Ramos, who wrote during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, is a fitting one. Liz Calder, again.
His interest and focus was very much on the less advantaged people of the Northeast, and that was his concern, and that is obviously a big aspect of the present, you know, movements and demos.
Brazilians have been taking to the streets across the country en masse, voicing their opinions on the country's poor social services and high taxes. Graciliano Ramos wrote extensively, and sometimes mockingly, about the pitfalls for Brazil's lower class. As a journalist, writer, and then mayor of Palmeiras dos Índios, he tried to improve life for those in the impoverished Northeast. Brazilian literature specialist Randall Johnson.
He had always expressed a certain civic responsibility. The short stories he wrote for the newspaper Indio in 1921 talked about the need for more schools and the neglect of education, talking about and sometimes ironically criticizing the owner of an electric company selling energy to the city. And then, when he was elected mayor, he did try to implement these ideas in a very schematic way. He was cleaning the streets, getting people to pay taxes, creating an urban plan.
With strong egalitarian ideas, Graciliano Ramos influenced a generation who found themselves trapped in Brazil's two-decade-long military dictatorship, which began in the 1960s. Brazilian musician and writer Gilberto Gil is among that generation.
Pela questão social no Brasil.
The social aspect of Brazil, the big symmetries that exist. Graciliano referred to all of this by identifying the political behavior that was surrounding this. The inequality in different regions, especially in the Northeast, which is where I am originally from, and the rest of the country, shows how the concentration of wealth is in the southeast of the country. These are big problems of income distribution, and Graciliano was one of the masters in respect to all this for my generation.
But in an ironic twist, protests descended on the festival itself.
Mais companheiros, porque é a falta de educação, é a falta de esporte na cidade, tudo isso gera contexto.
Protesters made their way from Paraty's old city by the waterfront, across the bridge which straddled the city's river, and towards the city hall by way of flip events. Even though this year's event profiled a writer who helped the underprivileged, many city residents feel that the festival was reserved just for Brazil's upper class.
Entendeu? Essa flip não traz benefício pro povo. Pelo contrário, paga-se dinheirão para ter esse evento aqui, o povo não vê o retorno.
Evaneci Cruz is one of several hundred protesters here. She tells me that Flip doesn't bring benefits to the local population and claims the city pays a high price to host the event, while citizens like her still remain unemployed. For festival goers, they watched on with keen observation as the protests ran through the city, all of that before they headed off to the next talk. Flip isn't just an event which takes place in Brazil. To show the world the country's history is more than just football and samba, in the first week of October, a week before the Frankfurt Book Fair, the first Flipside Festival will be taking place on the south coast of England. 12 writers and musicians are taking the trip to expose their work to an English audience, as Liz Calder explains.
There's a lot of interest in Brazil at the moment, as you know, because of the various things happening in the future and now. There was a lot of interest in the book that Grant had brought out last year, which was the 20 best young Brazilian writers in a volume. And that they travelled around England, and that created a lot of interest. Other publishers have been taking up young Brazilian writers. So I think it's growing. It's been growing slowly over the last 20 years, and I can see a lot more of it happening now and in the future.
Brazil is grappling with its own social and political complexities at home, many of which have struck a chord with the writings of Graciliano Ramos. But with the government now beginning to offer a response, there is hope that change may be on the horizon. And it's clear from the numbers attending FLIP and the growing interest in Brazilian writing abroad that this nation's voice will continue to be heard. Well, on the page at least. For Monocle, in Paraty, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Can you distill 60 years of global advertising campaigns into one book? We'll find out next.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we're finishing the show by taking a look back at a rather forward-facing industry. Regular listeners to Culture will know that producer Katie jetted off recently for the Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity, the ad industry's biggest international gathering on France's sunny south coast. Even keener listeners may also remember a reference in her piece to the Game Changers exhibition, which was part of the 60th anniversary of the event. But what you may not know is it's not just an exhibition. Game Changers, the Evolution of Advertising, is a whopping great book published by Taschen, which came out last month. Keen to find out more about it, how it's put together, and what it tells us about advertising then and now, we invited its key editor, Senta Slingerland, into the studio to find out more.
When we were thinking about the 60th anniversary, we wanted to do something that was celebrating the work of the last 60 years. But by doing that, you get into a danger of being just retrospective and just looking at old work. So we wanted to do something which was looking at old work and celebrating that, but at the same time look forward. So the way to do that was looking at the work that actually has changed the advertising industry itself. And by doing that, thinking, you know, where might it go next? So the concept kind of came from me, and I liked the idea of calling it Game Changers because it's really what changed the game of advertising. Right. And of course, then you get into the problem of, all right, okay, you have all this work, where do you start? So we put a little panel together of people that helped us, you know, navigate all this work and decide. And
you've got some sort of star names in there, Arianna Huffington, who our listeners will obviously know, John Hegarty, a sort of advertising legend as well. These people kind of chuck in their two pennies with, and David Bailey, of course, who started doing ads in the 60s and got into trouble for some of the things he did. These are all presumably people that have, well, they're big, they're not just commas in the sentence of advertising, but I guess they're sort of icons of that world. Did they kind of steer your editorial process as well, or were they just there to write a little foreword?
Depends on the person.
Right.
Their brief was very, very open, and what we wanted their piece to be was really an eyewitness account. They were the game changers of that time. They steered the work coming out of that time. So we wanted their story to just be a personal story of when they were working in the industry. They did advise us on which work they think should definitely go in, and we definitely took their advice on that. So, yeah.
It seems to me that advertising has changed as we go through the book, that maybe some of the iconic ads are nearer the front and it gets less so as you get nearer the back. Is that just me being an old geezer and going, oh, I want everything to be like a silk cut ad from the 80s because I remember them in the magazines I used to buy when I was a kid, because obviously I wanted to grow up being a smoker when I was a kid. That's a strange thing. But do you know what I mean? I wonder whether you found that, whether you feel that maybe the disparate nature of advertising across so many more platforms nowadays plays into that.
Well, first of all, I'd say that for something to be iconic, it has to have been around for a little while to get into the sort of popular culture. So that's one thing. And now also, as you go further into the book, you'll see that a lot of the pieces, not everyone would even call them advertising. There's some product in there. Mm-hmm. You know, that we look at Nike Plus and Nike Fuel Band. For some people, that's not even really advertising anymore. So can you call that an iconic ad? I don't know. And as you go further into the book, there's more work from different territories that people might not have seen, so would not find them so iconic. But that's kind of the interesting thing about the story of the book as well, that you start off describing the beginning pages of advertising, which is posters and some films. And then as you go further on, it's design and fonts and products and books and all sorts.
And there's also that idea of how ads change the culture and change the language. They don't, obviously, adverts or successful and iconic pieces of advertising don't just change the way that the industry works, but they change the language. People like Hello Boys. We were talking about I was looking at the Wonder Bra advert just now. And obviously, it's a wonderful thing when you get PR that, you know, it was causing traffic jams and accidents because people were swerving off the Westway in London looking at this sexy girl. How does that work? I mean, that's presumably, it's something to do with the PR that surrounds an ad campaign that is almost as strong as the advertising itself, right?
Well, that's kind of the beauty with advertising, isn't it? It enters the popular culture, and you might argue it's art in its own right. When you go through this book, and I've seen people flick through this and say, oh, I remember this, that was incredible. And it's really become entertainment for them at the time. And they, you know, they have emotional reactions to it.
Yeah.
Another thing is now with sort of brands being way more creative in how they talk about their products, you get artists collaborating with, you know, designers and technologists, entrepreneurs, musicians. To the festival, we have a lot of musicians coming and actors and politicians, and they all sort of work together.
Was it tough to make those last few chapters, if we're talking about the chronology of the book, choosing stuff that you think is going to change the game in the future? That's a little bit more difficult than putting in Think Small and the Levi's ad and things like this and Welcome to Marlborough Country, I suppose. These things that you're trying to look into your crystal ball a little bit, right?
A lot of the older ads, like Marlboro Man, they then pointed to what we should put in later. So Marlboro Man was proving a sort of global iconic figure. And then you started thinking, what has done that since? Not so many things. But there are, you know, that idea of this sort of iconic global figure has kept alive through the years. People do still, you know, sort of seek that. It might even be that there's too much new work. And in 5 years' time, if you looked at the book again, you'd say, actually, those four pieces didn't end up actually changing the game at all. you know, we'll have to wait and see.
And do you see, going through that book, it's quite a hodgepodge of different countries. Is advertising getting more international in the sense that maybe Argentinian, Brazilian, the creative coming from sort of emerging economies, we might say, is up there with stuff from the UK and with the US and with Europe?
I mean, it really is. And people have been saying that for a long time. And I think people thought they liked that story, but it wasn't really true. At the festival, we see it really, really is. Argentina and Brazil, Thailand have always been very, you know, well represented. But this year and the last 2-3 years, I'd say, we've really seen huge winners from Colombia, Vietnam, Romania, this year Puerto Rico, you know, the Philippines. So they're really, really coming up strong. And people are, you know, really looking at those countries to learn from as well.
That was Senta Slingerland, one of the key editors of Game Changers, the evolution of advertisers, and head of digital and creative at Cannes Lions. If you're interested in buying the book for your own enjoyment or to impress guests on your coffee table, which will groan with its weight, it's out now, published by Taschen. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be talking comics on the radio in Brussels and asking how Mali's upcoming elections are affecting the country's music industry. As ever, drop us an email if you want to get in touch. rb@monocle.com are the best starting place. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Kelly Bilboa. Holly Fisher mixed things up and mixed things down. Time for one final track this week from her Midori House session. Here is Nit Jam Rosie with Sissim Zambe. I'm off for a glass of Bordeaux or two in the French sunshine, so I see you this time next week. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.
Ooh, yeah. Mao Sun. Amambia bawa makumbu kabawa Sili won jaman Yeah Bia kod Bola bia na bibota kakuma kawa Malon en volan Asubia Bia basu Bina boya Nasina ibota kajang Bina boya papa Bina boya Sim samba Hey Kui ma yu Diti mama My inner ball been at the cuckoo saying, A young Jim at the yun, yun. A system sambles, a malam. It's my mum, my inner ball. My come above my man, yum, Asubia basa Bina boya Nasina ibota kajang Bina boya papa Bina boya Bina boya Nasina ibota kajang Bina boya papa Bina boya
Thank you.